for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Laurie Rubin was born blind, unable to see anything except white light. But that did not stop her from studying at Yale, handcrafting jewelry, and enjoying a successful career in opera. She's the author of a new memoir and has released a CD, both titled Do You Dream in Color? Laurie Rubin joins me in the studio to talk about how she and her family refused to let her disability define her. I hope you'll join us as well. You are always part of the conversation. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Welcome, Laurie. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm glad to see you.
Oh, thank
Laurie,
you.
Talk about where the title of your book and your CD come from.
Okay, well, the book was written or starting to be written before the CD came to fruition. And in about maybe a third of the way through my writing process, I met a wonderful gentleman named Bruce Adolph, and he had me do a concert with him with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. And a few days after we did the concert, he asked me if he could write a song cycle for me. And of course, when you hear a composer asking that question, it's just such an honor, and I was so excited. And I said, sure, what kind of poems are you going to set? And he said, well, actually, can you write a poem about your being blind? And it was a daunting process because I wanted something that wasn't going to be hokey, but I also wanted something that was really going to talk about what I wanted the world to hear about my life experience in a nutshell. So when I sat down to write it, the question that came to mind that people ask is, do you dream in color? Which is such a great question to use as a leitmotif for the song, because it you can answer it so many different ways. And so it allows me to get into the figurative and the literal meaning of that.
Perceive color?
Well, I perceive colors in different ways. I think throughout my whole life, I've perceived colors from how people have described them. Blue being like the ocean and the sky and things I experience in my own way, just from smelling the air around those things. And brown being the color of chocolate, which of course I taste. And green being the color of leaves and mint and all these other things. But I think beyond that, a color to me has an aura and a mood. And I can, even though I can't explain it to people, I sometimes tell people I have maybe had a past life because I feel like I understand colors and I wouldn't be able to tell you why, but I feel like I have a visual sense of them as well.
Chocolate, and certainly we heard about chocolate in that song there. One of the chapters in your memoir is called The $200 diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Well, I think that was a very difficult time for my family because they had no idea. They had never met a blind person before, or they hadn't. They maybe had seen them in all these historical anachronisms of blindness, but they really didn't know a person live in the flesh, and so they had no idea what was possible for me. And I'll never forget when my mom told me this story about how she asked these social workers about how I was going to go to college, and they turned to her and laughed and said, well, let's just watch her crawl first, and then we'll deal with college.
How did they know, or how early did they know that you could not see?
They knew. They started to get a sense of that probably when I was about 6 weeks old, because I wasn't smiling at visual cues. I would certainly smile and react to auditory cues and, of course, touch and all of and smell. But it wasn't when people would smile at me. And they also noticed I wasn't looking around a lot at when I would be supposedly people watching the way babies mostly do.
And what was the diagnosis?
The diagnosis is Leber's amaurosis, and that is that my retinas never developed. So the cones and rods in the back of the eye are what are missing. It's so interesting because people will often come up to me and say, you don't look blind. Are you sure you're blind? And I say to them, well, you know, it's the back of the eye. So everything in the superficial part of the eye is very much the same.
So how then did you begin to learn to read and to learn to read music?
Well, I learned to read at the same time that other elementary school kids my age were reading. So around kindergarten, I was learning the alphabet and I was learning the Braille typewriter, which looks like a futuristic or, I don't know, some very, I guess now it's very antiquated looking, but it's a very strange looking machine with six keys on it and then a space bar in the middle. And it's very loud and it's a typewriter. And I was learning to type on that while all my friends were learning handwriting.
How did your friends react to the fact that you were blind and using this typewriter?
They were fine. I think at a young age, kids just are much more sponges, much more easily acclimated to that than as an older person who's never come across it before. So they were just excited by all the things I did differently. I remember they used to want to know how my Braille writer worked. And they were also really excited when my computer would talk and they would have me write sentences of their choice, sometimes getting pretty funny and wacky.
And what about your parents early on?
Mm-hmm. They were wonderful. I always joke that the way, and they joke too, the way they got proactive and they found out that I was blind was they bought a 1979 Chevy van. And people say, well, why would they do that? What does that mean? And it's because they wanted me to go on trips all over the state to basically take in the world with all my other senses. So we would go on camping trips to Santa Barbara, the El Capitan Beach, and the mountains of Sequoia and Big Bear. And even though I have absolutely no recollection of most of those things, it was really early on. I already had a sense of how the world and nature worked and everything with my other senses.
And, of course, you have a brother.
Yes.
Older or younger?
He's 5 years older. And he was always a wonderful supporter and mentor to me. I wanted to do everything he did.
And did he help in the reading process?
Oh, in the reading process.
Yes.
Well, actually, it's interesting. And I talk about this in the book. When I was about 4 years old, I think that I started to understand what it meant about being blind because he was reading a book and I wanted to read his book. And when he showed it to me, I couldn't tell anything. It just looked very boring to me. All the pages felt blank. And I said, well, what's so interesting about this book? There's nothing here. He said, Lori, that's because you can't see it. And then I realized there was something he could do that I couldn't. But because I wanted to do everything he did, I was very excited when we could both settle on the playroom couch. We had this playroom and read books together. And I would read my books in Braille later on when I learned Braille, and he would read his books in print. And so we both really got a sense of the world because we were avid readers through the eyes of many authors.
So clearly your parents were in no way wishing to hold you back because you were blind or to treat you any differently.
Exactly. Yeah, I think they were just very, very cognizant of the fact that I should be treated equally in every way. And in fact, when I was in public school, and the teachers, the resource teachers at this school who dealt with blind students, when they wanted me to learn these machines that were very specific to blindness, there was one that was called the VersaBraille. And instead of typing normally, like on a computer, you type in the Braille alphabet. And my mom said, no way, Jose, she's learning how to type, because you don't use the VersaBraille in the real world. You use a typewriter at the time. Now it's computers. And everybody, it's so funny, they always joke that, you know, or my mom jokes that they probably thought, uh-oh, here comes Lily Rubin. We got to be careful now.
Now, did they call you Lily?
Oh, that was my mother's name.
I see.
She was always the one they were afraid of.
Gotcha. Laurie Rubin. She's an award-winning mezzo-soprano with a Master of Music degree from Yale. She's co-founder of Ohana Arts. That's a performing arts school in Hawaii. She designs her own line of handmade jewelry, which you can see on the web. I went up to your website, looked at the gorgeous jewelry.
Oh, thank you.
You designed and wondered how you chose color.
Well, I've always loved jewelry, and I've always loved clothing, and I see myself, and I think I said earlier that color to me has auras to it, and so I've always seen myself as a very bright colored person, or a very deep colored person in terms of what I like to wear. And so when I make jewelry, I'm always aware, of course, that everybody has a different aura. And so I wanted to make sure that the pieces I made represented those people and their beautiful qualities. And so for me, I always wear things that I have this necklace that's 5 strands of red and silver crystals that sparkle.
Short break here. We'll be right back. And if you just joined us, Laurie Rubin is with me. She's an award-winning mezzo-soprano. She's written a new book. It's titled Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. And she also has a new CD out by the same name, Do You Dream in Color? Do join us, 800-433-8850. One of our emailers, Arthur in Brunswick, Maryland, has asked us to post the poem for the song, which your guest just sang. So we'll do that with your permission, Laurie.
Of course.
Good. I'm glad. Now, I want to go back to your own development and knowledge and interest in music. How did that begin?
Well, when I was really young, my parents always played their stereo system, especially my dad. My dad's a gadget person. And the best music to really emphasize that wonderful sound, especially in the bass, was at the time classical music. So I would walk through the house through this landscape of music that I was hearing in all of our speaker systems. It was so funny. But so at a very early age, I loved Beethoven's Fifth, and I loved Peter and the Wolf. And I had this also wonderful teacher at a school for the blind that I went to for a very short time, and she played Peter and the Wolf for us, and I got a sense of how all the instruments have different personalities, and I also got to hold all the different instruments from the orchestra, and she had us play them. So I had a sense of when I watched an orchestra, I wasn't just like listening to it. It was actually having the experience of knowing how each musician would play that instrument.
Hearing individual sounds of instruments.
Mm.
Wonderful. And then somebody named Kenny Loggins
yes.
came into your life. How did he become one of your mentors?
When I was also, it always seems like the pinnacle year was age four, and maybe that's just how I remember it. But when I was around that age, my mother went to the supermarket, and we lived in the same city as Kenny Loggins, and she met Kenny in the butcher aisle. And in the meantime, she had been playing Kenny's music for me all the time in the car, and I just fell in love with his music for some reason. And I used to pretend he was my imaginary friend. And so my teachers would say when my mom picked me up, well, Lori had Kenny Loggins with her in the nap room today. But so it was really exciting when she met him at the supermarket, and he was really touched that I liked his music as well. So he invited us backstage at his next concert.
Oh.
Yeah. So it snowballed from there. We went on tour with him a lot. We went to all of his concerts in Lake Tahoe. My dad became his unofficial photographer. And I actually learned to water ski because of Kenny, because I was very precocious and wanted to do everything my parents did. So he heard me arguing with them about how I wanted to go water skiing with them. And Kenny said, well, of course. And he got an instructor on the speedboat that we were all on. And I skied and Kenny took a picture.
Wow.
It was pretty fun. Yeah.
Did you have any fear whatsoever on those water skis?
Oh, of course. But you know, when you're four, and actually at that time by the time we went skiing, I was probably about 9 or 10, but you feel like you're indestructible at that age. So even if there's a little bit of fear, that's part of the
wow.
thrill. Yeah, it was fun.
But even though you love Kenny Loggins' music, you chose opera.
Yes.
How come?
How did I make the switch? Well, so I started voice lessons when I was about 10 and a half. And of course the default was pop music. But then I saw Phantom of the Opera a few months later, and I just absolutely fell in love with it. And of course, even though it's a musical, the whole idea of it is about opera. And so my jump was not to musical theater, but to opera, because I wanted to sing like that. And I wanted to be part of these amazing, majestic productions. And so my teacher, who was a Juilliard alum and an opera singer, was so excited that one of her students of my age was interested in doing opera. So that's what led me into doing it.
And you became a mezzo soprano.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Describe what that means in terms of range, in terms of tone.
Well, I think chocolate seems to have been the theme because we talked about it. But mezzo voices tend to be deeper. A lot of people describe them as chocolatey. And they just sit a tiny bit lower than a soprano. So it wouldn't be as high-pitched and as lightweight, although there are some very nice, rich, heavy sopranos also. But it just sits a little bit lower, so you would hear more in the middle range than you would in the high range.
You chose something for this new CD
mm-hmm.
titled In the Mountains of Jerusalem.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about this piece.
Well, it's really special to me because I've always wanted to sing a piece in Hebrew because I'm Jewish, and I've done so much Yiddish and Hebrew. And this composer wrote this piece for me because we were asked to do it for a music festival. And I said, can you please write it in Hebrew? Because he's Israeli. And he said, well, I'd love to. And we've become really good friends and collaborators. And we've performed this piece a number of times. And it's so haunting. Not only does it have the Hebrew, but it has the neshoma, which is soul in Hebrew, that Jewish, you know, soul and cry from the diaspora from so many years.
Oh,
the difficulties of learning Hebrew to do that must have been really something.
Well, when I was younger, I learned Hebrew Braille because, of course, my parents expected, and of course I wanted to, have a bat mitzvah, just as my brother had a bar mitzvah at our synagogue, and consequently became the first blind bat mitzvah at that synagogue. But, you know, it wasn't so bad because, again, you know, when you're so young, your brain is like a sponge. And even though you use the same six-dot Braille system and you have to think of certain combinations of dots differently than you do in English, it just becomes second nature. And so I had a tutor who was also blind, and I used to go to her place, and she would teach me all the letters and the vowel markings and things like that. And it just became second nature. And when I was at Yale, my director expected me to learn how to learn Cyrillic Braille. So I also know Russian Braille also.
Oh my.
Not as well, but
now,
I do.
Before you got to Yale, though, you had a little bit of difficulty in middle school.
That's right.
Talk about why.
Well, you know, one of the things that was so interesting to me is that I've always seen myself as a normal person, just because that's, I think we all do. And that's just how our lives are. But the other kids had never met a blind student before, for the most part, so they were scared. And it's also, there's the whole thing about pressure about being cool. And they weren't sure if it would be so cool to hang out with somebody that was different. So I dealt with a lot of isolation, and kids not necessarily always being actively mean to me, but just sort of ignoring me and not expecting me to join their groups of friends. There were times when they were actually flat out mean, but that's just the age, I think. But it was very isolating at the time. And I began to sort of reinvent my identity in a very negative way, just because I thought, well, if this is how they see me, I must be that way. But of course, I've always been sort of very resilient, and I've bounced back. And so, you know, I think deep down, I always knew, no, this is, the way they see me is not necessarily how I have to be.
How did your parents react to the idea that other older students did not want to babysit you? Did they tell you that?
Oh, my parents were, they were horrified of all the sort of discrimination that I had to go through. But I think they also knew that, you know, they had gone through it for various reasons on their own. And in middle school, they remembered what it was like to be in middle school. And they just said I would get through it. And they were always very supportive of me, always. And they always made me remember who I really was.
Did the students with special needs sort of stick together?
You know, not necessarily. And I think part of that is because we didn't want to be lumped into a group. But, you know, also when I was at my middle school, I was the only blind student. And there weren't that many other students that had disabilities. The ones that did were not visible on the surface. And so there was one part that I talk about in the book where I was not supposed to let anybody know when I was in that back room doing my tests, when I saw another student. It was supposed to be completely anonymous when I was seeing another student getting tutored, because it was like the big scarlet letter that nobody wanted to associate with themselves, the D word, the disability. They didn't want to associate it. Which was a real shame, because I thought, well, if we acknowledge it and we're all okay with it, then we don't have to hide it.
Clearly, your parents gave you a very upbeat attitude about yourself. But then a family friend said something that you surely resented, as did your parents.
Oh, yeah, goodness. I remember I was on the school trip, and it was raining the entire trip. And there was this one time we were supposed to go on this hike, but I wasn't allowed to go. And of course, that upset me already. I was like so used to doing things with my family that not to be able to go on a hike was ridiculous to me. Then I found out they were using it as a way to blindfold the kids, to show them what my life must be like, which was also horrifying to me, because that must have been terrifying to them. And my life is not terrifying, because I've adapted over the years. But during that hike, there was a family friend that was on the school trip with me as a chaperone for just me, which was also
for just you.
Yeah, it was humiliating. But she was a family friend, so I thought it would make it better. But she ended up telling me that she can understand why the kids didn't relate to me, because I wouldn't be able to relate to them about makeup or romance or movies or anything, and that it would be silly of me to expect to have any kind of romance in my life, to ever think that I would get a job or live away from my parents.
What a cruel thing to say.
Oh, it was awful. But it just made, what was worse about it was not so much that she said it, but to know that it was coming from somewhere that maybe everybody felt that way. And then I thought, oh no, if everybody feels that way, how am I going to succeed? But then, of course, again, about the identity thing, my family reminded me that, of course, that's not how life is going to be. And I just have to stick to who I am and prove myself, and it would all be okay. And it was. And that's the message I really want to share with other teenagers, too, that everybody who goes through a difficult time during that time will get over it, will get through it, as long as they stay true to themselves.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. What about going to camp and what Interlaken meant for you?
That was, first of all, I went to camp a camp for the blind when I was in seventh grade. And I resisted it at first because, again, I didn't want to be lumped into a camp situation with other blind kids and be sort of in that stigma. But what ended up happening was I was very uplifted because I found a lot of other blind students who were like me. There wasn't anything else wrong with them. And we all bonded, and it made me realize that there's really nothing wrong with being blind, and we all have the same hopes, dreams, and desires. And then when I went to Tanglewood, this music program for students from high school all over the country, it was really eye-opening because people treated me not like a blind person they had never seen in their life before, but they treated me like a musician. And if I could sing and if we could all share in music together, they figured there was no reason to treat me differently. So that was really helpful in my life in that difficult time.
But when you got to Oberlin, what happened?
Oh, wow. When I got to Oberlin, it was amazing because the chapter is actually in my book about that time was called Once Upon a Time When Being Blind Was Celebrated. And it really was. I was just, the more different you were at Oberlin, the better.
My son went to Oberlin as well. So
such a great place.
It is a great place. But how were you treated? How was your musicality treated?
My musicality actually was treated really interestingly, I mean, very well in the beginning because I found the Baroque music department, which meant that I got to sing with all sorts of authentic instruments from the time. So gambas and violins and things. And that was eye-opening. And that led to a lot of my musical career later on. The opera department was a little afraid of me at first.
Afraid of
you? Yeah, they just didn't know how I was going to acclimate on stage. But eventually, they did give me a chance, and I did sing my first lead role in an opera, and that was really incredible because it was that complete Cinderella story of proving myself and then actually getting to be on stage. And
how did you manage the stage?
The stage was very convoluted because we had this set that was like a rotating set. It changed all the time. And I just got used to it. And, you know, I figure if you learn your own house and don't have to walk around looking at your, and you can figure it out pretty easily, it's going to be the same way with a set. So I don't walk around my house with a cane and I didn't need to do that with the set. But what actually happened was that our director, he had me walk around the stage with a broom. Because
to feel my way,
which worked, but he also had me wear dark glasses. And I said, you know, I don't need to wear dark glasses. Blind people don't always wear dark glasses. I don't want the audience to.
Why did he want you to wear dark glasses? Did he want the audience to know you were blind?
Yeah, he really, really wanted to drive it home. He really did. And I didn't feel that there was that need to. There's this just continuity of interpretation, but he really wanted them to. So, you know, there's always that thin ice that you're treading on. You don't want to, you know, to sacrifice your integrity as an artist, but you also don't want to sacrifice your position as the underling of the boss. So
what was the opera?
It was La Cenerentola, Cinderella by Rossini.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And many other people in the cast then.
Oh, yes. And it was really funny because there was two casts and I was in the short cast and there was a tall cast, and they were both, I mean, the cast that I was in was particularly close. And at the end, when I'm supposed to hug the stepsisters, I really did mean it, because they were, I mean, I never had any ill feelings towards these people. They were all so wonderful. And afterwards, they said to me, "Laura, you give the best hugs. And how could you hug us after we were so cruel to you as stepsisters?" I said, "Because you're awesome people."
Oh, I love it. Laura Rubin. And we'll talk more about her career, her music degree at Yale. We'll play more of her music and take your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture, poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.
We celebrated our 25th anniversary this year. On the next Fresh Air, we end the year with our special anniversary show. Join us.
Welcome back. Here is an email, the second part of that email from Arthur in Brunswick, who identifies himself as a classical singer. In concert or in opera, how do you, Laurie Rubin, watch the conductor? Is it primarily listening more closely than most of us do, or what?
I actually listen for certain cues that conductors give, which are so funny. All conductors, and I can say this very confidently, that I've worked with, are very, they gesticulate not only just to the orchestra, but they're very emotionally involved in a piece. So you can hear them grunting a little bit. You can hear them breathing. You can hear them crescendoing, because they kind of go, you know, and it's very subtle, but I'm with them completely 100%, because it's kind of like the way you would work with a collaborative pianist, in that you're listening, you're paying attention. It's a two-way street in how you create these interpretations together, and doing that with the orchestra is really fabulous with this conductor beside you. And the other thing is that, and not to sound judgmental or on a soapboxer at all, but you know, everybody has always said that you're really supposed to not look so much, but to pay attention to the music. And so I feel like, in a way, I have a little bit of an advantage with a conductor.
Because
I'm not always, especially when you're on stage and you're doing an opera, you have to check in with the conductor, but you have to be paying attention to your staging. And so that is very important to be able to tune in with your ears a lot. And the other thing is that conductors and I always have had a great relationship with being able to be honest with each other about what we're going to do and what they would like, if they'd like me to move a tempo more, if they'd like me to pull back. So it's always just about being straight with the person that you're talking to, that you're working with. And
excellent. Yeah. Let's go to Ocala, Florida. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning. I'm enjoying the show very much.
I'm so glad.
I have a grown son with a disability, and then recently I had a stroke, so I joined the ranks of the disabled.
Oh, I see.
In fact, my service animal and I are listening to the show together. My wife and I went through, and my son went through an awful lot of the things that you went through, you know, growing up. He's 27 now. But we have noticed in the last couple years, the battle gets easier every single year.
That's great.
We've noticed society gets a little more open. We've got more TV shows with persons with disabilities.
Yes.
I walk my service dog into a store, and I hear little kids say, "Ooh, that's a service animal. You can't pet him."
Yeah.
I mean, are you seeing this, that society just seems to get more open, and people like yourself and other people with disabilities who aren't afraid to hide in a closet like they did 30 years ago?
Indeed.
Right. Well, first of all, I have to ask you, what kind of dog do you have?
It's a black lab.
Aww.
And Aunt Maggie, she's 3 years old, and she's an alert dog. She will alert me to high stress and hopefully keep me from having another stroke.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great. I asked because I had a black lab poodle cross from the Guide Dog Foundation, and he looked like a Muppet, and I miss him terribly, but he was a great guide dog. But in answer to your question, I do think things are getting better because, as you say, kids are getting mainstream, so the other kids see disabilities as a regular life thing for them. I think a lot of times students know more than their parents, and they say, "No, Mom, you're not supposed to pet the dog," which is wonderful because these are our future generations at work here. And they're going to be the ones that govern and make rules and legislation. And so I think that things are getting better. I still think that there is the tendency to be gun shy about hiring people with disabilities because we're living in a very fast-paced society where people want productivity and they're so terrified of anything holding them back. So and instead of being able to take the time to get educated about the many abilities that people with disabilities have, they tend to go with a package that they feel is more complete when they're looking for an employee. So that's the big one. We still have a 70% unemployment rate in the blind community. But I do agree with you that things are getting better. I think socially we're being integrated more. People are asking more questions. Everything is more visible. So, yeah, and I'm very happy to hear that things are getting better for you and for your son.
Thanks for your call. Just on that point, I have recently learned that one of the networks has signed Michael J. Fox to a series focused on an individual with Parkinson's who is played by Michael J. Fox himself.
Wow.
So I do agree with you that more and more of that is really coming out. Let's go Denise in Davenport, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. I need to tell you the story because I have a very, very dear friend who was born almost blind, but then her eyes got diseased and she had to have them removed. She was in my choir. She learned the music by rote, and she was just wonderful. But one day in our conversation, she said, "Oh, that's my favorite color."
That's awesome.
I said, "Okay." How do you know? And she said, "Because whenever I'm wearing it, people tell me how lovely I look."
Oh, that's wonderful.
Great.
Yeah, that's a great story.
That's wonderful, yeah.
Someone has asked whether you dream in imagery. Do you see your dreams?
You know, I don't, because I'm sure that somebody who has lost their sight, and I know a lot of people who have, I'm sure they still dream in images because that's in their realm of experience. But for me, my visual cortex never developed with a sense of sight. So I dream, for example, I might dream that I'm sitting in this chair and with a pair of earphones on, and I can see light because that's something that I do. And I would dream that sense of awareness, but I wouldn't actually dream the images like they're on a TV screen. And I would gather most people dream like like their sense of awareness rather than like they're looking at their movie through it, looking at their dream as if it was a movie.
Clearly, life for you has been a series of progressions, but with dips along the way. You were so excited when you were accepted into Yale.
Yes.
And then it turned out to be a big disappointment.
Yeah, and I hate to, you know, I feel terrible saying it because in a way they were so, they just kicked me vocally. They did such great things for me. They pushed me, that's the word, not kicked. They pushed me vocally and musically, and I learned so much there. But yes, Yale, I was so excited to get into that program because it's so tiny. And most conservatories have big opera, voice programs, which then you have to audition for the opera. But Yale was already this tiny little program. So it really meant that it was for everybody in the program to be featured in some operas for their experience. So when I got into the program and still didn't get into an opera either year, it was devastating emotionally for me because I thought, well, I'm going to have so much trouble getting opera in the real world if they don't see too much of it under my belt already. And I almost left because I wanted to find a school that would support my wanting to do opera. But I stuck it out because it was such an incredible program. And they had this policy where they would give you music to learn for opera scenes. And 2 weeks later, it had to be completely memorized, completely, no books at all. And it stood me and others in such good stead because now when we're hired for gigs, and we have a very short lead time to learn the music, we can do it. We have the muscles to do it.
But what disappointed you about Yale?
Not getting into the operas for 2 years. It was really devastating. Because,
and why not?
Well, I had conversations with the director about it many times, and she just said, well, we're afraid for you to move on stage. It's too dangerous. And I said to her, I move around my own kitchen. I move around a hot stove. I cook. I rock around the streets of New York City, for pity's sake. You know, I don't understand why walking around a stage would be, as with so much controlled environment, would be so difficult. But it was too big of a leap for them. And, you know, it's just people have fears because blindness to them is what it's like to get up in the morning without your glasses on. But that's not how it is for me.
So eventually, did you get any singing role, starring role at Yale?
No, not once. Not a once.
So sad.
I know.
For them. Sad for them.
Oh.
But you became very excited about the music of Joaquin Rodrigo.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, when I was a teenager, I used to listen to public radio all the time, and they just happened to mention about Rodrigo, who I loved, that he happened to be blind. And I thought, wow, I never knew that. And it just goes to show that his blindness did not figure into the beauty of his music. And so I wanted to feature his music on my CD as another blind and very successful musician.
Singing that music must have been just extraordinary for you.
It was so fun. It really was, because his music has a very Renaissance, medieval kind of sound to it, even though he was around in the 20th century. It's just so beautiful. And so I love that, because I love early music and being able to make your voice almost like an instrument or a bell or something. It's really cool.
And that's how it sounds.
Oh, great. Oh, good.
That's how it sounds.
Thank you.
Tell me, Laurie, how did you come to the conclusion that you were gay?
Oh, well, for me, that happened over time, and I started to have dreams about it, And my mom said, well, don't worry about it, Lori. I mean, everybody has dreams, funky dreams like that, you know? And so I just put it out of my mind. But then as I got into high school, I realized that there were a lot of other students who might be questioning also. And then I had more dreams about it. And when I went to Tanglewood, of course, theater and music is the great place to meet other people who are gay. And I remember meeting this one girl who told me that she had been in a relationship with a girl. And I remember feeling so envious. And like I wanted to do that as well. When I went to Oberlin, of course, that's the best place to feel at home as a gay person. And so I had actually two relationships at that time, and one of them lasting 4.5 years. And then when I went to Yale, I met my current partner. So we've been together for 10 years.
That's Jenny.
Yes, oh, exactly. Yeah.
I'm glad for you.
Oh, thank you.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So many questions to ask you, and our listeners want to get into this program. To Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Diane.
Surely.
I had a really interesting experience today listening to the show because I have felt blind with Lori because a vast majority of people, I assume, have no idea what you look like, Diane. But we sit around and listen to the show and enjoy your distinctive but yet beautiful voice. And I wanted to thank you both for that experience.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much.
So lovely. Thank you very much, Ashley.
Have a good day.
Bye. Let's go to Vienna, Virginia. You're on the air, Victor.
Hi, and I wanted to comment that your guest has so much positive energy and is so lively. She's lovely, and she touched my heart.
Oh, thank you. Goodness.
You do inspire people, I think, Lori, with your positive sense of your own life, despite the drawbacks that others might feel you've been experiencing.
Aww.
Your parents have been so supportive in your life.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, tell me about this jewelry making and how you got into it.
I've always loved fashion. And it's so funny. People always... I had an argument with my dad when I was in ninth grade because I was saying, you know, blind people can do everything. They could even be a fashion designer. I was partly kidding. And he said, well, Lori, there's certain things you just can't do. You can't be a fashion designer. And it's so ironic because now I make jewelry and I love
it. How did you begin doing that?
Well, when I was in New York after being there for a couple of years... and being frustrated that I wasn't being able to be hired for, even as a voice teacher, people weren't asking me for second, even for first interviews when they would see my blindness on my resume. So I was feeling like I have a purpose. I know I have a purpose. I'm not supposed to just be just cooking our meals. I'm supposed to be doing something else. So I remember my mother's friend coming to New York, and my mom and she were visiting together, and I went and had lunch with them, and I noticed my mother's friend had this gorgeous bracelet. And I said, oh, I love your bracelet. Where did you get it? She said, you know, I made it. I'm taking a jewelry making class. And she said, you know, Lori, I don't use my eyes when I make jewelry. I do it all by feel. And I was so excited. And I called up an instructor from the Jewish Community Center in New York. And I said, would you please teach me privately? And she did. And she was very patient. And she taught me all the crimping techniques, all the wire wrapping. And then I just went to town. And I was like a kid in a candy store in every bead shop. And even just touching the beads and running my fingers through them and listening to them make all the sounds of that shoo noise. I just loved it. And so it just became a real passion of mine.
That's terrific.
Thank you.
And clearly, singing is a passion. We have as a last selection Foray's Claire de Lune. Tell us about this.
It's just such a beautiful song. It's like
is.
A painting. And my collaborative pianist and I just we loved the idea of doing a French set on this CD because the Do You Dream in Color piece has that impressionist sound to it. And I think this song in particular is just so loving and passionate, but in such a tender, graceful way.
Faudra
What a pleasure it's been to have you here.
It's been so fun.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Laurie, and congratulations to you on this CD and on your new book.
Thank you.
Title, Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.